From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations and comments featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Central to many political, economic, and cultural questions about the Middle East is ways in which the nations of that region view money and commerce. The concept of an Islamic economics, for instance, is relatively new, but has ancient social origins. This, according to one scholar, who recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center. He is Shaul Bakash, an Iranian journalist and scholar of Middle and Near Eastern societies. The discussion about Islamic economics also includes Bruce Lawrence, a professor of religion who specializes in Middle Eastern studies. Professor Lawrence teaches at Duke University. Here is Shaul Bakash.
Islamic economics has been developed by theorists and writers in Islamic countries, I think in response to three felt needs. First, there is the need to assert that there is an Islamic economics in the same way that there is an economics of capitalism and an economics of Marxism. It is then a response, a search for an indigenous economic theory in response to what are seen to be these overbearing economic ideologies coming from the outside.
Is it a matter of pride?
It is partly a matter of an assertion of indigenous cultural identity, but also it is a reflection of the disappointment with capitalism as a answer to the needs, the felt needs of Islamic countries. And to a certain degree, perhaps it is a reflection of the fear of Marxism and its attraction to the country's youth.
Mm-hmm. Is it an old idea? It sounds like it would be fairly modern.
It is a fairly modern idea. There has been writing on, as it were, the Islamic approach to economics for a longer period of time, certainly since the early 60s and perhaps as early as the 50s, but it hasn't become a burning question, as it were, until very recently, until the 70s.
Mm-hmm. Would you say then that in its relationship to the West, Islamic economics takes as its primary element money or religion?
I think it's an attempt to show that there is a third way that is neither capitalist nor Marxist. It is an attempt to prove that Islam as a religion is an Islam of the underprivileged classes, that it cares about such matters as the more equal distribution of wealth, the underprivileged. And thirdly, it is an attempt to show to a audience that is, of course, devoted to Islam and to the Islamic jurists themselves that the economic programs that the reformers are proposing are justifiable on Islamic grounds. This last point is very important because advocates of, as it were, socialism or more equal distribution of wealth in an Islamic country have to show that the programs they are proposing are acceptable within the norms of Islamic law.
Shaul, why would not Marxism be acceptable economically to adherents of Islam? Isn't there a strong component in Marxist doctrine of equal treatment for the underprivileged and the economically oppressed?
The egalitarianism is perhaps attractive to some elements in Islamic countries, but there are two, perhaps three problems. One is Islam, one of the most important is that Marxism is associated with godlessness. It is an atheistic ideology. Secondly, I think this is connected with a direct fear of the Soviet Union and its influence. And finally, it is alien. The question of cultural pride and the desire to assert one's own cultural identity applies here as well.
Mm-hmm. Apropos of what Shaul has said about Marxism, I think it might be valuable to note that there is a spectrum of ideological options that have been available to certain Muslim leaders and their countries during the past three or four decades since many of them achieved independence from colonial rule. And certainly one of those other options is what would be described as socialism.
Mm-hmm.
Arab socialism, but because it is implemented in Muslim countries, socialism, which must fit into a Muslim society and observe Muslim norms and fill Muslim expectations.
Well, give me an example.
Of those countries which have tried it, three that seem to be most evident are Egypt, Libya, and Algeria.
Mm-hmm.
And one might observe that in the case of Egypt, it was Nasser, who was the great pioneer not only of pan-Arabism, but of socialism as a suitable ideology, which would get at some of the same issues which Shaul raised about social justice, equal distribution of wealth, that are now part of Islamic economics.
Would you say that socialism in practice has been or is successful in these countries that you have mentioned?
Well, I haven't mentioned any beyond Egypt, but I would say that in talking about Libya, that it has been enforced at a much wider level with much deeper effect in Libya than anybody who thinks of Colonel Gaddafi as a militant mad hatter stoking wars among his neighbors or confronting superpowers at will could ever have imagined. So that, for instance, Gaddafi, despite the image or the stereotype of him as a military adventurer, is also a very serious advocate of Islamic socialism. And the book by which he operates, the Green Book, is modeled after Mao's Red Book and attempts to confront the clerics and to exclude them from power in Libya in an opposite vein from their inclusion at the heart of power in present-day Iran. So it is a further irony that while Libya, it would be a case example that I might cite on behalf of Islamic socialism and Iran, excluding the clergy, whereas Iran would be a case of an Islamic republic where socialism is not explicit but rather attention to Islam, that in the international sphere, Libya and Iran are allies.
Mm-hmm. Shaul?
It seems to me in Iran, for example, since the revolution, the chief impact of the economic policies of the Islamic Republic have been the state takeover of large sectors of the economy.
Mm.
The government has nationalized banking, insurance, large-scale industry, although a bill nationalizing foreign trade has not been passed. In practice, the government has taken over by far the largest sector of the import-export trade. It interferes in the domestic distribution of goods and food. And I think the same pattern has been repeated in Egypt, under Nasser, in Algeria, after the revolution there, in Libya today. So that what one has had very often in the name of Islam is a massive intervention of the state in the economy.
Yes, I would not have any disagreement with that. What I would make as a sort of brief qualifier to that that wholesale assertion is that one must look at Islam as something broader than these particular advocacies of state interventionist policies, and that to the extent that one can talk about Islamic socialism, I would say that it is a socialist engine which is driving a Muslim train.
Well, let's talk about some of those specifics, Bruce and Shaul. What are the elements that are peculiar to Islam that will be, how would you put this, transferable into economic terms?
I could pick up on it one level, and then I would like to hear Shaul also mention what, from his viewpoint, would be additional elements of the question. I would think that the first overriding concern of Muslims would be to identify what is the use of money, and in particular to isolate the use of money that is related to interest and to suggest alternate ways that are defensible from the viewpoint of the Quran and therefore from the viewpoint of Islam as a fair use, a proper use, a justifiable use mm-hmm. of money from an Islamic viewpoint.
Shaul, let me just ask you to add a bit of a footnote here. Is there any real difference in the way adherents of Islam and modern Americans look at money? I mean, are there fundamental differences in the way we regard the whole notion of money?
There is a fundamental difference in strict Islamic theory, which is that interest, or to use a more pejorative term, usury, is mm-hmm. forbidden in Islam. And therefore, the use of capital in such a manner that it yields profit without, as it were, being put to work is prohibited.
Mm-hmm. But that would be unacceptable to a capitalist, right? I mean, using money to make money is something that's central to capitalistic doctrine, is it not?
Well, in Islam, using money to make money without the element of participation in risk is prohibited.
I see.
And therefore, a holder of capital would have to either work in order to earn from his capital or to accept the element of risk mm-hmm. in applying his capital in a business venture.
Mm-hmm. Bruce?
Yes, I would add to that that it has become a preoccupation of those who are formulating the guidelines for Islamic economics to distinguish, as Shaul just did, between interest capital and risk capital.
Uh-huh.
And for these advocates of a defensible Islamic economic system, it is only risk capital which can be used and which can be advocated for the benefit of Muslims, whereas interest capital is prohibited and should be avoided.
Well, now, what about the apparent contradiction? You turn on the TV news and you see these fabulously wealthy individuals from the Middle East. I believe they're called sheikhs. Is that the way it's pronounced? And one wonders about some of these other people who don't have so much. Is that as much of a contradiction as it seems to be, Bruce?
I would say two things about this. First, Shaul made a valuable point about social justice and distribution of wealth as being a concern. One of those mediating factors in the Islamic system is that while there is an emphasis on distribution of wealth, there is also a very strong emphasis on retention of private property uh-huh. and the rights to hold and to use private property.
So that's an element of capitalism that appears to be attractive.
But it's a pre-capitalist form of Islam.
Uh-huh.
So it's
not something that Islam borrowed
from capitalism. Okay. This is something which goes back, as I said, to the scriptural antecedents which uh-huh. a Muslim would use to defend his view of economics.
Yeah.
Now, those individuals whom you've described as, let us say, politely, flagrant consumers,
yeah.
ostentatiously wealthy, are those who have upheld the right of private property but not paid attention to the category which Shaul introduced as central to Islamic economics, namely social justice and the distribution of wealth.
Mm-hmm.
So even though they have the title of sheikh, one might argue that they don't live up to it.
Mm-hmm. Does anybody remind them of their social responsibilities? Let me put that to you in the form of another question. How much talk is there in the Quran and the scriptures of Islam about money, about one's duty to the larger society? Do questions like that enter into a discussion about Islamic economics?
Indeed, the concept of the ummah, the community, looms large in Islamic scripture, and the responsibility of the owner of wealth to see to the poor is also emphasized. So that you do have, and this is one of the sources of conflict in the development of a theory of Islamic economics, you do have a conflict between the responsibility to the community as a whole and the freedom to engage in economic activity and to accumulate wealth.
From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You're listening to a discussion about commerce and culture in the Middle East. The topic is Islamic economics. The panelists are Shaul Bakash and Bruce Lawrence. Shaul Bakash is an Iranian journalist and scholar of Middle Eastern commerce and politics. He recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center, where he worked on a book about Islam and commerce in Iran. Bruce Lawrence is a professor of religion at Duke University.
Is there anything in the Islamic scriptures that would be the equivalent of Jesus saying, it's easier for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle than it is for a rich man to get into heaven? Are there notions like that in the Quran?
I think rather than saying there's an explicit dictum like that, one can quote several passages from the Quran where Allah, God, communicates to the Prophet Muhammad that it is essential to care for the poor, for the orphan, for the needy. And that sort of divine mandate has been used to support what Shaul earlier alluded to as a system for taking care of the poor, which is called in Arabic zakat. And one should mention here that, without using too many of these technical terms, that zakat, Z-A-K-A-T, is set in place from the beginning of Islam as what we would call the equivalent of tithing in Judaism and also observed in many Christian circles, giving of a set amount of one's wealth for the benefit of those who are indigent or in need.
Now, does that occur across the economic spectrum, or is that the responsibility solely of the what we might call the middle class, the upper middle class, and the wealthy?
It is incumbent on all Muslims. The proviso is incumbent on all Muslims who are able to expend money and therefore to give a portion of that for the benefit of others. So that to the extent that there are and always have been poor people in Islamic societies as in other societies, there are some from whom it's just simply impossible to collect zakat. But for all able-bodied, what we might call middle-class Muslim males, females, Muslim families, zakat, that is the giving of a 10% alms, is mandatory. The difficulty is that this has also become an instrument of state, and that in many Muslim countries, we already are looking at an apparatus of the state, which is used to collect this 10%, and then it's the state that determines the priority of who are the poor on behalf of whom it's expended.
In other words, the doctrines of Islam are being changed, what, politically, bureaucratically. Do I have that right? That the money doesn't necessarily end up where the fundamentals of Islam would have it end up.
Well, in most Muslim countries, the state does use obviously its revenues to a certain extent to provide for the poor, to provide housing, to engage in social welfare, and the like. But one cannot then go on from that to say that in the wealthiest Muslim countries, has there been success in creating egalitarian societies?
But it is fair to say that in, for instance, notable countries that we could think of, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, the countries of the UAE, also Bahrain, another Persian Gulf nation, in all of these countries, it has been possible to maintain a very high standard of living for all citizens who qualify as members of that nation state. And within that large segment of the world that's identifiable as Muslim, there is not a distinction of a church of Islam. Rather, everybody who is a member of the Muslim community or ummah is able to qualify for the benefits as well as to be responsible for the exacting duties.
Islamic economics is a theory of economics which seeks both development and social justice. What I think one is struck with, in addition to the many doctrinal and practical problems of implementing the theories that the advocates of Islamic economics have advanced, is that when it comes to five-year plans, for example, there is very little difference between those countries that claim to be pursuing an economic line of Islamic development and those that are not. Or very little difference between, for example, the Iran of the monarchy and the Iran of the Islamic Republic. The framework, the constraints, the possibilities seem to be pretty much the same. In Iran, for example, since the revolution, a number of programs have been attempted under the rubric of Islamic economics. The government, the revolutionary government, has attempted to implement a land distribution program. It has nationalized banking, insurance, major industry. It has attempted to take over foreign trade, and at least it has paid lip service to egalitarian economic policies. In trying to implement these programs, both doctrinal and practical problems have arisen. To take the doctrinal first, many of the leading Islamic jurists have objected, for example, to the land reform program, that you simply cannot, under Islam, seize private property, which is what land distribution came to. Many Islamic jurists objected and successfully blocked the law to nationalize foreign trade by arguing that Islam allows freedom of economic activity. And by nationalizing trade, the government was restricting this freedom. So that much of what the advocates of Islamic economics hope to implement in terms of social programs have either been vetoed or blocked or by objections raised within the Islamic community. In other words, the leading theorists of Islam or the leading jurists do not agree on what is proper economic policy under Islam.
Shaul, just a footnote there. When you talk about the jurists of Islam, are you talking about the leaders who speak from doctrinal positions? No separation, in other words, from the legal and the religious system.
Yes, I'm talking about the clerics who are experts in Islamic law and therefore qualified to pronounce on questions of Islamic jurisprudence.
Mm-hmm. Bruce?
You could say I want to add this kind of just to highlight a lot of issues we've raised so far, that you could say that that's hypocrisy. You could say that is something which is a blatant contradiction. But I think what's probably at least as important to recognize is that whatever we, and we all are at this table, and perhaps most of our listeners will also be non-Muslims, whatever we as non-Muslims might make as a judgment about this, in a certain very real, keenly felt sense, for Muslims, the effort to find an Islamic norm, even if it cannot be observed or fully implemented, is itself valuable. And what Shaul was pointing out very much at the beginning of the program, that you have seen since 1973, really in the last decade, and one might argue even more specifically since the dramatic change of polity in Iran since 79, an effort to find what would be an Islamic profile, an Islamic mode of understanding, implementing, and living in a dependent world where there are non-Muslims as well as Muslims, where there are interest-bearing economic institutions as well as those that attempt to be non-interest-bearing, in every instance to find what is an Islamically authentic and appropriate way of being. It is a very new endeavor. And I think we should not, even given the literature that existed before 73 about it, it is a very new endeavor, and it really would be presumptuous of us to say now, because of what we feel are contradictions, gaps, seeming hypocrisies, that therefore it won't work.
It should be dismissed.
Yeah. It should not be dismissed,
right.
I'm arguing.
Right. Is it, Islamic economics, creative or is it synthetic? Shaul?
In the writings of Islamic economics, what is most striking is the attempt to infuse or to fuse together elements brought from the outside with Islamic concepts. For example, in the writings of Muhammad Baqir Sadr, a Shiite who wrote and lived in Iraq, there is a very impressive effort to argue from Islamic theories, the Quran, and Islamic legal traditions for policies of social justice. For example, if Sadr is arguing for the more equal distribution of wealth, or he's arguing against large gaps in income, he always finds in Islamic traditions justifications for these policies. Now, one obviously is struck by the fact that many of these ideas seem to be very similar to ideas argued by socialists in Europe. Therefore, what we have, I think, in Islamic economics is a fusion of ideas from the West and indigenous ideas.
I would agree with what Shaul said, and I would only express my own estimate of the question as perhaps un-Islamic in its formulation, because to be creative rather than synthetic would be to interpret the initial foundations of Islam, that is the Quran, with reference to loyalty, fidelity to the precepts, and then an effort to implement them in a particular concrete context, so that creativity, Islamic creativity, is by its very nature always foundational, always presupposes that scriptural norm of the Quran. And what Shaul quite correctly said is that the extent to which certain advocates of Islamic economics, or as I earlier said, advocates of Islamic socialism, have used the Quran or used sources of scripture such as the Hadith traditions of the Prophet Muhammad merely to justify their own programs that were conceived beyond and even outside or against what would be an Islamic framework, it is a misuse of that creativity which Islam itself attempts to foster. And I think what Shaul has very neatly summarized in terms of the Iranian context is something which could be applied to any other Muslim country and its circumstantial situation or context. Namely, that those people who are truly Islamic, those people who concern themselves with the Quran and with the themes and tendencies of the Quran itself and its implementation of social justice, will give serious weight to the relationship between expediencies of the present day world, that is to say, the marketplace for economic transactions, and weigh those against the prohibition or interdiction of interest. Understanding that you can't simply extrapolate from a 7th century Arabian norm an exact dictum that is applicable to 20th century interdependent global economies. And in the same way that one cannot simply, in the name of egalitarianism, strip private property or allow those who hold private property to disregard the rights of others within a society. That kind of delicate balancing, that effort to understand the whole context and not only one's rights or privileges within it, is something that is not peculiar to Islam, but it's something that those who are Muslim, genuinely Muslim, exercise in those countries of the world about which we're speaking.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to a discussion about commerce and culture in the Middle East. The topic was Islamic economics, and the panelists were Shaul Bakash, an Iranian journalist and scholar who recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center, and Bruce Lawrence of Duke University. At the center, Shaul Bakash worked on a book about Islam and commerce in Iran. Next week on Soundings, another discussion about commerce and culture, this time from a Western perspective. The panelists will be A.W. Coates, a scholar at the National Humanities Center, working on a history of the American Economic Association, and Crawford Goodwin, an economist from Duke University. Soundings would like to hear from you. Send your comments to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible by grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Listen to Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center inviting you to join me this week for a discussion about commerce and culture in the Middle East. Central to many political, economic, and social questions about the Middle East are ways in which the nations of that region view money and commerce. The concept of an Islamic economics, for instance, is relatively new, but has ancient cultural origins. Listen for the insights of Shaul Bakash, an Iranian journalist and scholar at the National Humanities Center. Also joining in the discussion is Bruce Lawrence, a professor of religion at Duke University. Commerce and Culture in the Middle East, this week on Soundings from the National Humanities Center on this station.